Last week we got through scene two of this first act into the first 12 verses of Job chapter 1, laying the background. And I want to do a little bit of review because it is so important that we understand the real issue here. Most people, when they come to the book of Job, they come to the book of Job with the idea in mind that it's a book all about suffering. And while I certainly would not deny that suffering's part of the picture, it is by far not the main theme. As I've been trying to stress, the main theme is all about the character of God and how we understand who God is and how he runs this universe, so to speak. And so the key to the whole book is found in verse 9, when Satan, having had his attention drawn by God to this man, Job, who's a righteous and upright man, God says, have you considered him? And Satan, of course, obviously has considered Job, because his response was, does Job fear God for nothing? In other words, what's going on here is a cosmic situation where Satan has accused God of operating this universe as a business, of having a relationship with humankind that is a contractual arrangement, where God says, you do what I want and I'll bless you. And that's Satan's charge against God. Does Job fear God for nothing? Job's in it for himself. He's not in it for you, God. He's not in it to worship you. He'll worship you, but only for what he can get out of it. And of course, that has huge implications for one's view of God. So that's the crux of the issue, and that's what everything in this book is built around. There are sub-themes, no question about it. Suffering is a sub-theme, but we have to see it as a sub-theme. We have to see that the character of God is being impugned by Satan here. That's the big theme. How does God run this universe? What is the basis for the relationship between God and his worshipers? That's the key question. And of course, Satan, having made that charge against God, does Job serve God for nothing? Satan proposes that he be allowed, actually what he says is that, God, why don't you do damage to Job? And then see what happens. He'll curse you to your face. And God says, okay, Satan, go for it. Only don't touch Job. You can touch anything he's got, but do not touch Job. And that's where scene three opens. And as I mentioned last week, the very fact that God allows Satan to act against Job in that way disproves at least half of Satan's theory. Because God is not operating on a business relationship. He has allowed Satan to damage Job. He wouldn't do that if it was a business relationship where give and take are in play between God and those who worship him. So Satan doesn't realize it, but he's already lost at least half the battle. But that brings us to scene three, the earthly outworking of that heavenly test, beginning in verse 13 of chapter 1. And like I said last week, we want this as interactive as possible. So if you have questions or comments, please raise your hand and we'll get the microphone to you as quickly as we can. First part of this scene, we find Job losing everything. Verses 13 through 15 of Job 1, we find that he loses his cattle, his she-asses, and his servants who are taking care of them in a Sabaean attack. Verses 13 through 15. On the day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing, the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans attacked and took them. They also slew the servants with the edge of the sword. I alone have escaped to tell you. Now, as I mentioned last week, the Sabaeans, this is one of the hints that this whole drama of Job took place probably in the patriarchal period or just before the patriarchal period. Because at this point, the Sabaeans are obviously a nomadic tribe traveling around raiding to make their living, so to speak, whereas later on in Old Testament history, the Sabaeans become the kingdom of Sheba, and you've all heard of the Queen of Sheba. So that's part of how we date this. But here the Sabaeans are attacking. They're attacking from the south. Satan, you notice, is using human means to get to Job. He's using these Sabaeans. Verse 16, he loses his flocks and his shepherds while he was still speaking. So this messenger is still finishing his story about what happened with the ox and donkeys. While he's still speaking, another also came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." So here we have not a human means, but let's call it a natural means. It's not really natural, is it? But somehow, fire came from heaven, lightning or whatever the case, and caused Job to lose all of his flocks and all of his shepherds except one. Verse 17, Job loses his camels and the servants that are caring for those. While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three bands, made a raid on the camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." So human means, nature means, again, human means now with the loss of the camels. And notice, as I mentioned again last week, here the Chaldeans are acting as nomads. They're raiding camps and so on. So that's another clue. The Chaldeans, of course, ended up basing themselves in Babylon and becoming very settled in later centuries. What we know of as Iraq, by the way, today. Then verses 18 and 19 come the big blow to Job. While that messenger, verse 18, was still speaking, another also came and said, "Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And behold, a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house. And it fell on the young people, and they died, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Nature. So we have human, and then nature, and human, and then nature. I'm pointing that out because I want you to realize that Satan has a lot at his disposal when he's given permission by God. Okay? And he obviously learns, he uses it, I should say. You notice that it has been stressed through all four of these occasions that they come right on top of each other. Job learns about all of these events at essentially the same time. We're being told that, and that is being stressed so that we can begin to empathize with Job. What would it be like? I mean, any one of these, and I'm speaking by experience, any one of these would have a tremendous effect. But here on the same day, within the same hour, all four of these events are reported to Job. The devastation that that could bring to him is great. And we all know that the temptation that comes with that kind of demonstration is even greater. For one to question God, for one to start to make charges against God. May I also point out that this is everything Job has except for one thing. And he has no insurance coverage, I might add. None. He has just lost everything except his wife and four servants. That's it. And of course, the question could come, well, why did Satan spare Job's wife? Think maybe that was more torture? No, why did Satan spare Job's wife? Victor?
Because she was an unbeliever.
You think Satan would spare her if she were a non-believer? I'm guessing that Satan would probably want to take her then, knowing Satan. So I'm not sure if that would be the case. Susan?
Because they won, basically, Job.
Because Job and his wife are one? Okay, that would be the assumption that Satan would honor that. Again, I would wonder about that.
I was thinking that he had plans on using her.
I was going to add the same thing, because she's about to tempt him to curse God.
Okay, I think we're getting closer to it. I do not picture Satan as honoring anything God has established. I don't picture him honoring marriage. I don't picture him giving somebody an opportunity to hang around and become a believer. So I would question, now we're conjecturing here because we're not told that Satan preserved Job's wife for any reason, except for what follows. And that's why I would lean towards what Mike and James have just suggested. Probably he preserved Job's wife because she would become part of his scheme to try to lead Job to curse God, which is Satan's whole purpose, remember. He loses this bet, if you want to call it that. He loses in this debate between himself and God. He loses unless Job curses God. His whole goal is to get Job to curse God. That's what will prove Satan's point. And so he's going to do everything he can for that purpose. Does this address the issue of free will? I think you're going to have to develop how you think it might before I can answer that. Satan, I would not say Satan is controlling them. No. He's just making it easy for the issue to come up. Yeah, I don't see Satan controlling either one of them. He uses the Chaldeans and the Sabaeans, but was that against their will, would be my question, and I would say no. He knows their will. He knows what, he's just, somehow God has given him the opportunity of directing them to where they're going. Yeah. By the way, I don't believe in free will. I've never believed in, I shouldn't say never, but I do not believe in free will. I do believe that we have choices to make, but our wills, from the moment we were conceived, our wills were never free. We've always been slaves of sin until Christ freed us. So we need to keep that in mind. I never use the phrase free will if I'm using my head anyway, if I'm thinking about it, in other words. Somebody else, David.
Well, this is a little bit of a side trip, but I mean, this is kind of a, when you think, if Satan left his wife, Job's wife, alone because he knew, means he knew what she was going to do, or she knew about her, so that he's clever and he's got a lot of knowledge. He knows the situation. He knows who Job's wife is. That's sort of a commentary on who he is. That he's clever, but he's a vanquished foe. But when we're up against a clever enemy.
Very much so. In fact, I was asked last week, can Satan read our minds? And my answer was no. He can't read our minds, but he's very perceptive about us as sinners. He knows where we're likely to go. He's seen all of history, you know. He knows what we would be tempted to do, and he's certainly going to put everything in place so that that temptation would be very real. So, yeah, I definitely agree with what you're saying, David. He knows he's set things up well for Job to be tempted as strongly as he is able to tempt Job. Okay, then we come to verses 20 through 22. And if we're caught up in this drama at all, if we realize the basic issues that are involved in this drama, the huge issues that are involved in this drama, at this point, we breathe a sigh of relief as spectators, as readers, as watchers of the scene. Because we find here that Job maintains his devotion to God. Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell to the ground. The first three actions that Job performs here, getting up, tearing his robe, shaving his head, Those show how extremely troubled he was. They also show how very confused he was. What in the world is going on here? At the information he's just been given about all of his possessions and his family as well. But the next thing he does, you notice, after mourning is to worship God. In fact, I would suggest that his worship of God is part of his mourning, the loss. And so we read that he fell to the ground and worshiped. And then verse 21, he says, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there." The Lord gave. What did the Lord give? Every single animal, every single servant, every single child that he just lost. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. What's the point that Job is making here? Brian?
The things that were given and the things were taken away were not Job's to begin with?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. It's the other viewpoint of that would be, whose are they? They are God's. And it is his right to do as he pleases with anything and anyone. So Job is in the midst of his pain. And believe me, we have no clue of how deep that pain would be. None of us have experienced we've experienced similar things and the same things in smaller doses. But in one day, to have all of this happen, none of us experienced that. And yet Job is able to, by the grace of God, he is able to acknowledge God's right to give and take as he pleases. And when he says, "I came into this world naked and I'm leaving this world naked," what Job is pointing out is, I wasn't owed anything. Not a thing.
At this point, has Satan lost on both sides?
So far, the question is, has Satan lost on both sides? And yes, that's the point of these three verses is, whoops, you blew it, Satan. You're done as far as it goes right now. But he's not done, as we all know. Verse 22, though, puts that even more strongly, that Satan has lost so far. For we read through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. Or as I would prefer to put it, he did not impugn the character of God. He did not, the note in my Bible says, ascribe unseemliness to God. The point is, Satan has to get Job to curse God or he loses. And here it's saying, Job isn't even close to cursing God. He's not even close to that. So praise the Lord. But that opens up for scene 4. Because, of course, what happens here on earth is very much seen in heaven. And so we come to chapter 2. And we have another occasion when the sons of God come and appear before the Lord, before Yahweh. Which means that we're starting to get a picture here, aren't we, of an idea that that must be a regularly recurring event. There's an ongoing accountability to those for whom God has given responsibility across this earth in the spirit realm. There's an accountability. There's also an accountability for those whom God has not given a responsibility, but they have access, namely Satan. But there's an accountability here. And the key characters in this fourth scene are the same ones that were in the first heavenly confrontation, namely Satan and the accuser and Yahweh, the Lord. And the subject, once again, verse 3. The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job?" Now, if God were human, I would suggest that in that question there was this na 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 na, but he's not human. But he is going to draw Satan's attention to Job once again, because now it is a Job who has been tested, who has been tried in a severe way, but who has been faithful. And of course, Satan has to admit since it wouldn't do any good to lie to God. God says, have you considered him? There's no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. And then God adds a couple of statements, you notice. Two additional statements. Number one, he says Job is still holding to his integrity. He puts it like this. He still holds fast his integrity. In other words, God is saying, yeah, Satan, you lost. You lost. The second aspect of what God is saying, you notice, is he says Job still holds fast his integrity. Now get this. Although you incited me against him to ruin him, what are the next words? Without cause. Those two words are so very important, and I would guess that for some of us, they are going to transform the way we think about events in our lives. God is stating clearly, and he is stating directly, that the trials that Job has just experienced were not brought on by anything at all wrong with Job. Now, he's not saying Job is perfect, but he's saying that these particular trials in Job's life were not brought on by anything that was wrong with Job. That ought to blow to smithereens some basic assumptions that many Christians operate by, and which in fact is a major reason why God put the book of Job in his Bible, is to blow those assumptions to smithereens. And they are very dangerous assumptions. This is going to become of great importance when we get into the huge center portion of this book, is to realize that God himself has said these things came on Job without cause, for no reason in Job. There's a big reason, but it's not found in Job. Job is not the central character in this book. So, the conversation, verses 4 through 6. Satan's response to what God says is, okay, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has, he will give for his life. However, put forth your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, then he'll curse you face to face. So basically, Satan, the accuser, is claiming that the previous test was not really hard enough because it didn't threaten Job himself. So you notice he's got his foot in the door as far as Satan is concerned. He got God to agree to the first one, but God had told him he couldn't touch Job. So now Satan is complaining, basically, saying, yeah, well, of course Job survived because you didn't let me touch him. And my thesis is still valid, Satan is saying, because it's still, as far as I'm concerned, a give-and-take relationship. You just didn't take enough, I guess is the way to put it. You did not harm Job enough to show that give-and-take relationship. Skin for skin. Job is doing okay because he's willing to lose all that he has as long as he himself is not affected. In other words, Satan's still acting as the accuser. He is saying Job is being totally selfish. He is willing to trade everything and everyone else's well-being, including his own children, for his own well-being. Let me stop and just make an observation here. Do you realize how much like Satan we sometimes act? That's a dangerous statement, isn't it? No, I'm dead serious. How much like Satan we act? We are like this adversary whenever we're making accusations against others that are based on assumptions. Because that's exactly what he's doing. He's made his own assumptions, and he's making the accusations, he's making the charges based on those assumptions. I don't know about you, and I know this is something we've all done. I know this is something we are all tempted to do. But I'm pointing this out because I don't want to be like Satan. I don't think any of you do either. So I want to make us aware of the fact that that is a very dangerous thing for us to do, not just because of the harm it does to our relationships, but because of where it aligns us, with whom it aligns us. Okay? So let's keep on going. Verse 5. The accuser makes another proposal. Put forth your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh. He will curse you to your face. So ruin Job physically. And Satan is convinced that Job will curse God. And once again, look at that, verse 6. The Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your power. Only spare his life." You can do what you want, Satan, except Job has to stay alive. Well, I would guess that Satan would want that anyway, because his goal isn't to kill Job. His goal is to get Job to curse God. So that's not much of a limitation as far as Satan is concerned. But once again, God's very agreement with Satan's proposal is a demonstration that his relationship with Job is not that relationship based on a contractual business agreement. It's not that give and take agreement. There's got to be a different basis from God's perspective for his relationship with Job and with all of the people that God has blessed, all the people who would be called his worshipers. So there's scene 4. Mike.
The first agreement that they made, that Satan made with God, he didn't initially say that he didn't think that was enough. But when Job did not end up cursing God, then Satan comes up with another proposal and says, well, that wasn't enough. But he didn't realize it at the time, or the first agreement. So he's making another agreement, and then God is limiting him to not killing him. And it just seems odd that Satan is agreeing to this one now too, without thinking it through. That okay, so what happens if he doesn't? And is he going to say, "Well, yeah, but you saved his life," or something like that?
Good observation. Satan kind of sounds like some professional athletes trying to excuse a loss, doesn't he? But I think what's really going on, and I'm glad you pointed this out, Mike. I think what's really going on is it's becoming very evident to us, and I'm giving a whole bunch of stuff away here now, but it's becoming very evident to us that Satan does not have a clue of the power of the grace of God. There is no one so blind as Satan. I hope you realize that. We human beings are blinded as natural human beings. We're blinded by sin. But the grace of God, we call it God's common grace. God's common grace has worked in our lives in such a way that there are some things that we can understand, even as natural human beings. But Satan, he is total evil. Not just total in his heart. He is the total outworking of evil. He is so blind, he can't even see the grace of God at work. So his assumption is that Job is not being affected by the grace of God. And that's his fatal assumption, because the basis for the relationship between God and his people is grace. It's not this contractual agreement. So that's what Mike is observing here, just putting it into different words. Satan is blind to the power of God's grace. And therefore, even if this didn't work, he would love to make another agreement, a third agreement, but where do you go after a third agreement? If Job dies, he's dead. You can't do anything more with him. So Satan has nowhere to go if he loses this particular arrangement with God. Yeah. Okay, scene 5. The earthly outworking of the second heavenly test, as we've called it, beginning in chapter 2, verse 7. What Satan decides to do, you notice, in verse 7, is to smite Job with what are called boils here. Sore boils. Now, if anyone's had a boil, you know that just one is enough. Yeah, it's plenty, in fact. But he strikes Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, top to bottom. Job cannot walk. Job cannot really do anything. Covered with these boils, the only thing that he is really able to do, we see in verse 8, scrape himself with pieces of broken pottery. Now, more than boils, more than sores is involved here. And I want to point this out and show you what I mean by that. Because these boils bring on multiple problems, multiple symptoms. Perhaps the nurses among us can understand this even better than I can. But let me just show you the scriptural evidence for what I just said. It's, yeah, the pain and the just the horribleness of the boils themselves is part of the problem, but not the whole thing. Job is experiencing these boils, and by the way, it's the same word as was used for the plague in Egypt back in Exodus. Same word for boils that is used in Exodus 9. Turn to chapter 2, verse 8. Well, not turn. Look at verse 8. He took a potsherd to scrape himself while he was sitting among the ashes. Now, why would he be scraping himself? Remind you of things like mosquito bites? He's itching like crazy. Yeah, so that's another symptom. Look at verse 12. When his friends come, they lifted up their eyes at a distance and did not recognize him. What's that tell us? That tells us that at least his facial figures were so distorted that he couldn't even be recognized by his friends. Then look at chapter 3, verse 24. Job is speaking, and he says, "My groaning comes at the sight of my food." Okay, what's that tell us? That tells us he has no appetite. He looks at food, and all he can do is groan. That's it. So he's lost his appetite. Then move over to chapter 7, verse 5. Yes, this is going to get pretty ugly, pretty gory, so stick with us. "There are worms in his sores. My flesh is clothed with worms and a crust of dirt." So worms and scabs are covering his body. Verse 5, "My skin hardens and runs." Worms, scabs, and pus. He's dealing with over his entire body. He has, if you go to chapter 9, verse 18, he has breathing problems. "He will not allow me to get my breath." You go on to chapter 16, verse 16, and you find that his eyes are sunken. That's no surprise. He's not eating, probably not sleeping. How do you lie down and sleep in that condition? But he says, "Deep darkness is on my eyelids. In other words, his eyes are sunk. Chapter 19, verse 17. Here we can feel bad for his wife. "My breath is offensive to my wife." He has bad breath brought on by all of this. Verse 20 of chapter 19. "My bone clings to my skin and my flesh. I have escaped only by the skin of my teeth." In other words, severe weight loss is taking place in Job's body. Was this happening over an extended period? Well, it was a week that those friends sit down with him without saying a word, and this is all happening after that. So we don't know how long it was, but we're probably talking about at least a matter of weeks. Yeah. Cheryl?
Back in the Old Testament times, wasn't it true that if you were like unceremonially unclean, you had to be outside the camp? So was he like forced to leave his home and go to a separate place?
This being either patriarchal or just before the patriarchal times, it's very unlikely that those regulations were in place. Also, the fact that Job was a very wealthy man and he's in his own home, he probably wasn't in town. He was on his own estate, I think is how we would put it. Yeah. Let's move on to chapter 30. If you hadn't guessed this, I mean, this is a pretty much a given, but Job wants to state it for us. Chapter 30, verse 17, he tells us about the constant pain that he is experiencing. At night, it pierces my bones within me, and my gnawing pains take no rest. Verse 27 here of chapter 30, he describes what we would call inner tension going on within him. I'm seething within and cannot relax. Wow. Some of us know what that's like. Then look at verse 30. We've described the worms, the scabs, and everything. Another way that he puts it now, my skin turns black on me. It would take a nurse, perhaps, to tell us what that means. I'm not going to. I think you'd get sick. Then verse 30 as well. My bones burn with fever. This is one oppressed man. So verse 8, back to chapter 2, I should say, verse 8. Job scrapes his boils. He sits in the ashes. And then we come to verse 9. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? You're really going to stick this out, Job? Curse God and die. Most preachers and teachers that I've heard talk about this present Job's wife as somebody who is saying this in disgust. She's tired of the bad breath, you know. She's just sick of him and his suffering. I don't happen to take that attitude. I don't happen to see that. I don't think she'd be nearly as effective in what Satan is trying to accomplish if that was the case. I think she is doing this completely in compassion. I think she is hurting so badly at seeing her husband hurting so badly that she is willing to say goodbye just so that he can be at peace, just so that he can have some degree of comfort. And I think what she's saying is, curse God so that you will die. And this will all, the suffering will all be over. That's my, you know, we're not told, so I'm not being dogmatic about this. But the point that's being made here, whatever her motivation was, the point that's being made here is that this that she is suggesting was exactly what is necessary for the accuser to be proven right, for Satan to be proven right. Let's attribute to Job's wife the best motives that we can, shall we? And let's learn from this for a minute. Her motives may have been good, but her action, her words, her method was very, very wrong. She reminds me, in fact, of Peter. Remember Peter? When Jesus in Matthew 16 verse 21, when Jesus is telling the disciples that what's going to happen to him in about a year, he says the Son of Man has to go and is going to be put to death. And Peter says, no, Lord, not you. And that's when Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. See the similarities? Good motives, wrong actions, and good motives do not excuse wrong actions. Ever. Okay? Her motives may have been good, but they do not justify her telling Job to curse God. They do not justify that. So, Job, in his pain, and this is what amazes me, here's the grace of God coming through so strongly. Job says to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity? And even in all of this, Job did not sin with his lips. He acknowledges, in other words, he rebukes his wife. He acknowledges the sovereignty of God. God is sovereign. Should we not accept the adversity along with the blessing? Should we not view adversity as from God? And therefore he has his purposes? Now, Job's going to waver in this as we continue to go. But here he's stating it very well. Very well. God has willingly allowed Job to be robbed of his health as well as all of his possessions. And yet Job is refusing to speak evil of him. And therefore, the accuser is wrong. Mike.
At this point, did they have a view of eternity? Because they first God and die, so you're going to be suffering. But then the eternal suffering and hell.
I can't pretend to know what she was thinking at that point. I'm guessing that that wasn't even part of her thinking when she was saying that. I think she just simply wanted to end the suffering. I think that was all that was going on. As to how she understood eternity, as to how Job understood eternity, we'll find out more about Job and eternity as we go into the later chapters. They knew more than we give them credit for, but they also didn't know everything any more than we do. So, Cheryl.
The other thing that I thought was interesting is that God chose to spare Job's wife, whether she was a good woman or not. At the end, he carried on the family line through her at the end of the story. So that shows me the grace of God.
Yeah, and I'm also intrigued by the fact that while God rebuked Job at the end, and he rebuked Job's friends very strongly, not a word is said about his wife. And I'm not sure why. Perhaps because it doesn't really fit in with the purpose of the book. That would be my guess. But yeah, it is intriguing, whatever the case may be. Okay, but the conclusion of this matter here, at this point in the story, is that the accuser has once again and more fully been proven wrong. Satan has been proven wrong again. Job is still devoted to God, even when he has been completely ruined personally. Now, I'd like to take a few moments here and ask us to consider the cosmic implications of this. The cosmic implications of Job's faithfulness to the Lord, even when he had no clue of what was going on. And we got to remember that. We know what's going on in heaven. Job didn't. In fact, there's no place in this book that indicates that Job ever found out what went on in heaven. Okay? But as readers of this drama, we know that there are cosmic implications. The heavenly scenes tell us that there are cosmic implications of what was going on and what Job was experiencing as the very worst of what could happen to a believer in this life from an earthly perspective. So, as you think about that, what are some of these cosmic implications? This was not merely a matter between Job and God, in other words. All of the spirit realm, evil and good, the entire spirit realm is listening. The entire spirit realm is watching with, I would suggest, bated breath to see the outcome of what's going on here with Job. They are represented at least by the leaders that are reporting to Yahweh there in heaven. But I would suggest that the whole spirit realm has got to be watching, got to be listening, and with bated breath, because what's really at stake here? The very character of God is what's at stake from an observer's perspective. You see that? This is not just a matter of Job. This is a matter of the universe. The sooner we grasp that, the more we'll realize how major this book of Job becomes in our understanding of God and our understanding of Satan and our understanding of the relationship that exists between God and those who worship him. So, let's make some observations here. What can we observe about Satan from the story so far? I've already made a few, but let's just think about that for a few minutes. What can we tell about Satan from these first two chapters?
Persistence.
He is very persistent. Anything else?
He can do anything.
Oh, he will do anything he can. Yeah, I think that's a safe statement. He will do anything God allows him to do to bring on evil. Brian.
He's an accuser.
He very definitely an accuser. And that's one of the things that every time I come to this book just strikes me, his brazenness in standing before God and accusing God. I mean, he is willing to go that far. That is really something to me.
Satan has convinced himself that God really isn't. Sovereign.
The statement is Satan has convinced himself that God isn't really sovereign. And I find so much humor in that because he's convinced himself of that even as he's being shown. When I talked earlier about how blind he is, he's the most blind creature in the universe. He's convinced himself of that in the face of all of the proof that that sovereignty is absolute. Yeah. You ought to have no respect for Satan. There should be a healthy regard for him. Be sober, be vigilant. Your adversary, the devil, goes around like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. You need to keep that in mind. But you should have no respect for the guy. There is nothing within him to respect. Oh, just scratching the head. Okay. Susan.
It was just more of that. His pride in thinking that he can best God is eclipsed only by his ignorance. The belief that he's asking God for permission, even though he's saying,
yeah, his arrogance is really something. His arrogance in the face of all the evidence. Yeah.
Would you call it stupid?
From a spiritual perspective, from a moral perspective, stupidity is a pretty mild word. Yeah. But I think we need to be careful in making such statements about him. They are true, but we need to be careful that in making such statements, we aren't arrogating ourselves. Because we've got to realize he's a lot craftier than we are. Okay, David.
Well, I guess along the same line, like we said earlier, he's perceptive, maybe morally and spiritually, maybe stupid.
Yeah.
He's very perceptive.
Yeah, stupid does not always mean not brilliant. A lot of brilliant people are really stupid. Yeah. Especially if we're talking about moral and spiritual matters. Okay, the other thing I want us to think about, and we don't have to express everything, but we've talked a little bit about what this shows us about Satan, but more importantly, what is it telling us? What are these first two chapters telling us about God? Again, I've said a few things, but there might be, while I would be able to summarize a description of Satan as absolute evil, what about God? Susan.
Well, clearly omniscient. He knows Satan, he knows Job, he knows all the circumstances well enough to not flinch it.
Okay, he is omniscient. Anything else? From our perspective, his weakness?
No, it looks like weakness from our perspective.
Oh, okay.
Actually, the ultimate strength, and that would be, in this case, grace.
Yeah.
Being a
Okay, what looks weak from our perspective is actually omnipotence at work, along with, I would suggest, wisdom, insight, understanding, all of those things working together. But that's a good statement. Yes, we have pretty skewed perspective sometimes, because we are so limited in our perspective, time-wise, and we don't see the whole picture even in this moment of time. But God does. He knows the end from the beginning, and he knows everything in between. He even knows, here's where my mind goes crazy. He not only knows what's happened and what is happening and what will happen, he knows all the possibilities that could have and could be in the future. Okay, I'm lost. But that's God.
That makes me think of it. And that Satan himself, since he roams to and forth through the earth, is he able, we've said he's perceptive, so is he able to sort of take in everything that's happening on the whole earth? Is that part of his vast, powerful cleverness? And he's able to, and we only see from our perspective, because we don't roam the earth, we're not roaming the whole earth. He is, so he can kind of size up.
Yeah, but we have the internet. Actually, I'm saying that kind of in jest, but also very purposefully, because I think there's an analogy there. We have the internet, but that's a pretty modern invention. For most of human history, we have been very limited in, you know, it's only been in the last century that information has been able to travel with any speed at all around this world. Satan is not omnipresent, nor is he all-knowing. He doesn't have any of those characteristics. He is a limited creature. But at the same time, we have to realize that Satan also has his own internet, so to speak. He has his own network of demons. And so he's had an internet a lot longer than we have, is what I'm pointing out. He has the ability to gather information from all over, even though he himself cannot be everywhere at once. Mike.
Can he travel from point A to point B?
Go ask him. I would think so. He roams around the whole earth, seeking whom he may devour. He tells God that he's going but hither and yon on the earth, so he is somehow able to traverse. Yeah. So, and it is 10 o'clock, and so I want to honor our time, and we will pick up next week. I do want to say this. I made the first half of a statement that I want to complete. I said the accuser has been shown to be wrong. Satan has been shown to be wrong in his accusation against God, as well as against Job, whom God has graced so much. So Satan's assumption about the relationship between God and his worshipers is wrong. But that's all the farther we've gotten. And I want you to be aware of that as you perhaps even read ahead. What we have not yet learned from the text here in the first two chapters, what we have not yet learned is what is the basis for the relationship between God and man. Now, I've given you, you know, you've learned it from me, but we haven't seen it here in the text yet. We haven't seen it stated. We haven't seen it portrayed. The second thing I need to point out here is that Job, at this point, has no clue why God has allowed his most difficult circumstances in life. He doesn't have a clue. All he knows is that's what's happened. All he knows is that the sovereign God has been willing to put him where he's at, in the dust, in the ashes, without his possessions, without his children, only with a wife that wants him to curse God and die. That's where Job is. And that's where we pick up on when we begin Act 2. Next week, and prepare yourselves. If you thought the description of Job physically was rough today, wait until you get his mental state, which is what we address when we get into Act 2 here. And it's painful. It's painful. Lord, would you continue to help us to understand what you're doing in this marvelous book? And would you help us to be willing to go through the tough part, just like Job was put through the tough part, that we might gain from this book that vision of you, that understanding of you for which you designed it. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.